iftar meal of traditional Palestinian food. The event will be from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Native American Student and Cultural Center at Portland State University, located at 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. That's this Saturday, May 18th, from 7 to 10 p.m., Palestinian Cultural Night.
Hello to all of my friends. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. You were just listening to the sounds of Palestine in that ad just now. I'm going to be there tomorrow night at Palestinian Culture Night at Portland State University. So shout out to all of my friends in Super, a group that helped to get my political footing. Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, Super. So I hope to see y'all there. And let's celebrate Palestinian culture and end the occupation. We're not talking about that tonight. Okay, so tonight in studio, I have Beth Vile, who's on the board of the Northwest Abortion Access Fund. So as many of you know, this week has been an exceptionally bad one for pro-choice advocates, people who know that anyone who needs an abortion should be able to get one. No one should be forced to bear a child against their own will. And one of the people who are helping to lead that fight nationally, who I think deserves your support, I'll be spending the next hour with to prove to you that she and the movement for abortion access deserves your support. So in studio, I have my friend Beth Vile. Hi.
Hello, hello.
Beth, I am just hoping that first you can let some of the viewers know a little bit about the history of not just the Northwest Abortion Access Fund, but abortion access funds, period. Why? And some background.
Yeah. So the Northwest Abortion Access Fund is relatively new in the sense that it was two funds originally. It was one that covered all of Washington and Idaho, called the CARE Project, and the national. And then the one that covered Oregon was the national. Was the Network for Reproductive Options, excuse me. And so they kind of came together. They realized they could cover more space and help more people if they worked together instead of working in tandem. They could be one organized effort. And so they cover Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and more or less Hawaii.
So I wonder why the fund part. Like, can you talk about the need for people to have their abortions funded?
Sure. So that kind of plays a little bit into the history of abortion access in general. So in, I believe it was 1976, Henry Hyde brought forward the Hyde Amendment, which made it so that Medicaid could not fund abortion.
Sounds like a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he basically, his thought process there was, there's a quote of him saying, if I could legally, anybody having an abortion, a rich woman, a middle class woman, or a poor woman, I would ban it. But the only vehicle available right now is the Medicaid bill.
So the Medicaid bill comes in.
Mm-hmm. Right after Roe is passed, almost three years later.
And begins to save people's lives, right? I'm on Medicaid. I was raised on Medicaid. Most people I know and love are on Medicaid. Shout out to my listeners if you are on Medicaid. And it provides medical attention, health access, where otherwise people would absolutely be priced out.
Mm-hmm. And so he made it so that couldn't cover abortion. So then everything was supposed to be either by private insurance or out of pocket.
And that's where abortion access funds come in.
Mm-hmm. So what we do, there's over 70 of us across the nation. We've been around for over 30 years. What we do is people call in, and for ours in the Northwest, we have what's called like a warm line. Some hours we are open, some hours we're closed. But if we're closed, you can just leave us a voicemail, leaving some specific information about what your needs might be. We get back to you, and we help assess how much we can fund you for that week.
Excellent. So how do people contribute?
So we have an annual fundraiser. We actually just had it about 2 weeks ago. It's a bowling themed fundraiser. It's called Bowlathon. People around the country do different ones. We brought in a rug at our one in Seattle. We had one in Seattle, one in Boise, and one in Portland. And our one in Portland brought over like $97,000.
Thank you to everyone for bowling in Portland. $97,000.
Yeah. Incredible. It was good. It was good. I know we had some were more successful than others, especially with the state of abortion access around the nation. So we have a big annual fundraiser, and we also have an annual ask to our reoccurring donors. And then, of course, we do, just small fundraisers when we can, but we mostly have to put our time and energy towards our hotline, and so fundraising really only comes twice a year.
So when you spend your time on your hotline, what happens on the hotline?
So kind of as I was saying a little bit earlier, people call in, we call them back, we establish basically how far along they might think they are, if they have an appointment already set, what type of abortion they're seeking, if they're in need of any practical support, so like travel, lodging, childcare, food, etc. We make sure that we can cover all their bases as much as possible.
And this is a nonprofit organization,
mm-hmm.
So like tax deductible if people donate.
Mm-hmm.
And in case my listeners missed the bowl-a-thon, how do they contribute?
So we have a website. It's NWAAFUND, that's NWAAFUND.org. And we also have Venmo, and we have Square Cash, all those things.
All that good stuff.
All of it's okay. The same.
Just Google Northwest Abortion Access Fund,
mm-hmm.
and then see where you go donate.
Yeah, it's a pretty big button.
Okay, so thank you for laying out some of the background, just about who you are and why you are, right? So,
mm-hmm.
And some of the history of it. So thank you for laying that groundwork. Now we can talk a little bit about today.
Sure.
What's going on? For people that are paying attention and their hearts are wrenching, can you just give a little bit of a synopsis as Northwest Abortion Access Fund sees some of the attacks happening right now?
Sure. So we're really fortunate in Oregon. We have the Reproductive Health Equity Act, which establishes that our state Medicaid will cover anyone's abortion regardless of income or immigration status. Washington has a similar law, with just a few minor differences. Unfortunately, Alaska and Idaho are pretty restrictive. They have limitations of 15 weeks with things like consent, need for parental consent or judicial bypass, things like 24-hour waiting periods, things like other barriers of that sort. So that's where a lot of our funding goes, is to more a red or more conservative states, mm-hmm. like that. So we focus our time there because a lot of those states have trigger laws. So what that means is that if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, then abortion would be immediately 100% restricted, illegal in these states. Quite a few states are trigger states or have trigger laws.
What does that have to do with Georgia, Alabama, Ohio? Because many people are sort of pointing to the draconian nature of some of the laws that are being passed, some of the lawsuits that are being drafted. Like, can you give a little bit of a synopsis about what's happening in other places, like nationally in headlines?
Yeah. So basically, there's a lot of different forms of barriers. Different laws take different, have different effects, and they're all generally moving towards the same thing. So there are trigger bans, like I kind of mentioned before. Gestational age bans is what we see in Mississippi, Ohio, Iowa, Missouri, Alabama, all those states that have been in the news lately. We see them with their, it's called a quote-unquote heartbeat bill, which is the misconception that at 6 weeks, a fetus has a heartbeat. What that actually is just like cardiovascular tissue, and it flutters as it's growing. Most people know, it's kind of prevalent in over social media right now. Like, that's only 2 weeks after the average person who can conceive. That's only after their missed period. So it's as close, since Roe v. Wade is on the federal level and they can't federally 100% ban abortion, they have these roundabout ways of these laws that make it so that it's the most difficult, the most inaccessible as possible.
Many people who I've been reading are saying that these laws are not meant to actually stay on the books necessarily, but mm-hmm. that they're hoping that it will get to the Supreme Court eventually so that they can legislate more widely, and that the mm-hmm. the sort of brashness and the boldness of some of these bills, and I mean boldness in maybe not a great way here, sure. but they're bold, right? Mm-hmm. That they're meant to make people enraged so that they will take them to court and that they can take those cases all the way to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. So we've seen over the last year or two go from laws like this in the 2 digits, like 100 level, to like over 350. Like, it's a very calculated attack on abortion access. It's a bit like, you see they're trying, like, at any turn there's all different kinds of bills, even in different states. We see these specific ones that are the most restrictive, mm-hmm. getting the most attention, but that doesn't mean those are the only bills in those states.
You said 350? Mm-hmm. Right now?
Yeah, this year.
Whoa.
Even in Oregon.
Okay.
They've had, like, some type of, abortion-restricting legislature come through.
Okay. And this is in the state houses and senates? And
yeah.
Okay.
So they create bills like this because they know they want to bring attention to it. What they're doing is they know it's unconstitutional, or they're trying to make it as, like, they want to toe that line as best they can, so that they will get sued. Like we saw in Kentucky just a couple months ago, they had the same type of thing happen where they got it all the way to the governor's desk and it was signed into law, and the ACLU immediately started to sue them, and so it couldn't, because it had been written to go into immediate effect, and they were like, not about it. And so as we know it, as we are right now with all the legislation passing through at this moment, whether it's been signed into law or not, abortion is still legal in all 50 states until the end of the year.
Okay. So first thing I want to bring up the fact that, just to bring a little bit of hope to people who are feeling hopeless,
mm-hmm.
a few years ago there was a proposal in Poland to ban all abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Women led a general strike,
mm-hmm.
and won their rights in one day.
Yeah.
Women in Ireland helped to lead a campaign for abortion access that also won.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just like recently, right? But we've already done this here, and in other places in the world they've done it and they're doing it. I don't want my listeners or anyone to feel like because there is a restriction somewhere being put in place that that's the be-all, end-all. These things are only as permanent as people allow them to be permanent, and that people already are fighting back, and we should be sure to join them and to support them. There should be massive upheaval
absolutely
behind this. And I think that my listeners should help with that upheaval.
Absolutely. And you see that in other states more than you see in the Pacific Northwest. In a lot of states like Ohio and Georgia and Mississippi and all over that region of the Southeast and Midwest, you see these funds and these organizations being led by women and queer people of color. And, you know, it's that overlying, those intersections of oppression where people, they know how to fight because they've done it their whole lives and they're tired. And you see they're not willing to take anyone's crap anymore. Yeah. Like,
it's been very interesting watching how the formations are coming together across the country of people who are launching and leading this fight, that many people who are not gender normative, right, that are not like cis women, cis meaning not trans, you know, and of course that mostly that is the face of this movement, and it's okay if that's your story, if that's who you are, you're a cis woman. I'm very happy to support anyone who's fighting, but I'm very interested in how people who do not fit into that mold are some of the most militant players in this struggle. And I'm thinking about bodily autonomy more broadly, particularly bodily autonomy under a decaying empire, which we find ourselves living in, that desperately has to cling more and more to its military might to stay relevant, because there's no way that the U.S. is going to be able to bounce back economically the way that it has been the sort of the world superpower. I mean, it is in decline, as other parts of the world, particularly China, right, are on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this as part of a larger drumbeat to war, right? George Carlin, you know, great comic, social critic,
mm-hmm.
said they want live babies so they can turn them into dead soldiers. This is, it's coming in very clear to me.
It's what we see a lot is what's kind of worked up to where we're at right now. I mean, as many people were very aware of, the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh.
Oh, dear.
That was a very...
We tried. You know, we
did.
We had a big demonstration in Portland, other places all over the country. You know, I want you to finish, and I also just want to say thank you to everyone who participated in demonstrations and activity against Kavanaugh that took time and energy out of your day to try to fight back.
Yeah, it didn't go unnoticed. I think the whole world was watching, mm-hmm. As the U.S. tried their best to resist the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh. But you also see what's kind of led to this is this like wave of single party rule in certain states. Like you see, you know, you get that like GOP trifecta of like an all red Congress, a red governor, and a red president. Like you've got these states that can be easily targeted by this uprising. And they've been, it's a more of a calculated attack than an uprising, I suppose. Of the pro-life movement, that's these politicians act as their puppet because they're well-funded. You know, the conservative right. I guess I should use pro-life more loosely to a more anti-choice movement. You see organizations like Right to Life. They're very well organized. They're very tactical. And they target specific areas of the country so that they can move in and lobby and move this legislation through.
So you mentioned Kavanaugh. If you could just give a little bit of background about his stance on abortion so that people can know a little bit more about him. He's the newest person on the Supreme Court.
Publicly, during his confirmation hearing, he said that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. He's not here to overturn it. And that's not, he was very roundabout, very vague, but still trying to check all the boxes of mm-hmm. not being too controversial. Mm-hmm. But we've seen him in the past act in the opposite manner. There was a time when there was a migrant teen at the border trying to seek an abortion. So she, as she was being held by ICE, and he didn't allow her to do it. He said, he came up with every, I don't remember off the top of my head, but there was this big rhetoric about, what about her family and what will they think? And it's she's separated from her family and she's pregnant. She doesn't want to be. So, and, that was a month long endeavor of its own. So we know, based on his actions more than what he said, that Kavanaugh doesn't view Roe v. Wade as the law of the land, and that we know that he's more conservative than his predecessor, and that he was specifically chosen to fill that spot because he is a conservative-leaning court justice.
Mm-hmm. So what would it look like if the Supreme Court arrangement sort of panned out the way that the pro-life lobby wants and abortion access is made more difficult or impossible? What does our society look like?
I think that's what a lot of people fear, is they fear that the unknown, and because there's a lot that isn't talked about, because people have viewed abortion access as something secure and not to have worried about. During the last election, you hear a lot about people, advocating for this or that, and a lot of things were brought to the table, and abortion access was one of them, but it definitely was kept second tier. It's not, people are nervous, people were nervous about it, but I don't think that they were genuinely afraid, in the, at least the general public, in the way that maybe they should have been. For people who are a little bit more well involved, we could kind of see this coming, based on these things that we've seen over time, the radicalization of the right, the increase. We didn't really start seeing these overbearing laws, and since it's only been since 2011. When they started doing.
So I'm thinking about a scenario. So
yeah, okay.
Particularly some of the horrendous, preventable, brutal deaths
mm-hmm.
that have occurred because someone did not have legal access to an abortion. I think some people don't understand how common it still is.
Absolutely.
To get an abortion, even if it is illegal, and how dangerous it is.
Right. And the one we see the most is, the wire hanger. And it's probably the most gory, and it's the most sensationalized because of that. But people have been providing abortions for thousands of years, well before modern medicine. So there are abortifacient herbs and fungi that have been used in other cultures and in other societies for that thousands of years. So not every people are afraid, and that's valid, because people don't want to go back to a time where they feel like they have to sneak around mm-hmm. and pursue doctors that aren't approved by the American Medical Association. Mm. But there are other options. We still have the abortion pill.
Can you talk about the abortion pill?
Yeah. So the abortion pill is, there's two. They work in tandem. The most common known is misoprostol. What that is, it was originally an ulcer drug that one of the side effects they found was spontaneous abortion. And women, it was women in Brazil that they had pieced it together that, we can get this ulcer drug over the counter, and they'd start taking it, and they'd buy it in mass, and they'd start taking it, and then the government caught up with them and made it illegal. But that information spread, and so...
Can you say the name again and maybe spell it for people who are listening?
Oh, I don't know if I can spell it.
Okay.
But I could try.
Yeah.
So misoprostol, it's misoprostil, I think. Close enough.
I want people to, who are listening, maybe to like listen up.
Yes.
And hear the name of the medication.
Mm-hmm.
Because it may be important to you.
Yeah, and the second one is mifoprostone, super similar. So miso and mifo.
Okay. So this is the abortion pill.
Yeah, so
please
one...
Please talk about it.
So basically, you take your first... As of right now, if you were to go and get the abortion pill, you'd go to like a Planned Parenthood or a clinic of some kind. And you would go and they make you take the first pill in clinic, and then the other four you can take them at home in the comfort of your own home. And there are four pills that you just sit in the pockets of your mouth, two on top and two on bottom. And what they do is they cause your uterus to expand. And so which will then lead, the first one blocks your, thank you.
My producer just came in the room. Thank you very, very much to my producer who looked it up online.
That's so sweet.
He has the spelling for
misoprostol. Misoprostol is spelled misoprostol.
Boom.
Thank you. So basically.
Shout out Jerron. My producer, thank you.
So basically, you take the first pill, and that kind of stops the hormones from keeping your fetus or your zygote or whatever the pregnancy from. It stops supplying the hormones your body is producing. Basically, it acts like a birth control, mm-hmm. but. It kind of rebalances your hormones to how they would be otherwise. And then the four you take act as they cause your uterus to expand and then expel whatever is in there at the time. And mm-hmm. so for people, that can look anything from a heavy menstrual period to some pretty heavy bleeding. But it's 100% safe.
What about the cost?
Well, depending where you get it. So with clinics, it's about $400. You can get it online for about $95, but around $95. But with the FDA being the FDA,
the Food and Drug Administration.
Oh, thank mm-hmm. you. They are finding ways to block its entrance to the U.S. in that capacity, which basically nonprofits or organizations will fill your prescription online. You'll talk to an actual doctor, and then they'll send your prescription to the warehouse, like the manufacturer in India, and then from India they'll send it straight to your door. But it's no longer, it's currently like under review, not really legal in the U.S. At the moment. Not necessarily a no, but it's definitely under question. And then from there, so basically what you're paying for when you go to the clinic is all the support ahead of time and all the support afterwards, because you have to do an ultrasound about a week later to make sure that everything is expelled so you don't have the risk of mm-hmm. Sepsis or anything like that. And so that's...
Is that kind of... And if you don't know, it's okay, but do you know if that treatment is available through Medicaid? In Oregon and Washington, where my listeners are?
So it is through state Medicaid?
Yeah, just to be able to get the care that you need before and after?
Yes.
Okay.
So at least I know more about Oregon than I do Washington.
That's okay.
But in Oregon, there's a whole list of reproductive like procedures and medications and things that are all offered under the Reproductive Health Equity Act.
Okay. And misoprostol is one.
Yes.
Excellent.
The medication abortion.
Excellent.
Also, surgical abortions are also available. So it's pretty all-encompassing. We're very lucky. We're the only state of its kind with legislature like that.
So people who need abortions in Alabama, Georgia, Ohio, some of these other places, can they also get their hands on misoprostol as well?
They can. There's other options too for states like that. There's a organization called Women on Waves, and what it is a Dutch OBGYN created this program organization that you go and you get on a boat and then you move into international waters, and international waters are whatever flag you fly is where you are.
It's a reproductive cruise.
And so they fly the flag of another country where it's legal.
Reproductive justice on the high seas. Mm-hmm. How fabulous.
Okay. Yeah, so they'll just move. There's options. The pill is available in those states currently because it's still legal, and there are other ways. I mean, people are resourceful. People are resilient, and they'll find their way around it. And
I want us to help with that
there's
resource
also
base, you know, for resourceful people.
Yeah, and telemedicine is also plays a big factor into that. So
talk about that.
If you live in rural Alabama, Mississippi, etc., every state is different with telemedicine. I know in Alaska right now, so like that's a state I work directly with, they can do telemedicine so that you don't have to come if you live out in like way out in Alaska, that you don't have to come all the way in on more than one occasion because it can be a flight. And right now it only covers the first flight. And so they're trying to work legislation to cover the second flight. So if you do have to get things reevaluated.
And is this Alaska only that they're considering?
There are other
this?
States okay. like that. Every state is pretty different in my experience. Everybody has different barriers based on the people who live there, and they're like, you see a lot of harsher legislation in the Southeast and Midwest because you see, and I mean, not saying the Pacific Northwest is too much better, but you see a lot of their legislators being almost entirely older white men. Although that wasn't the case of how this bill got passed in Alabama, we know that it was a white woman who brought it forward and a white woman who signed it into law, which kind of dispels that whole myth of we can't, not dispels, but like is goes against the whole white feminist thing of being like, well, white men can't make decisions for us anymore. Well, in this case, it was white women, and like we have to own that and reevaluate what we're doing to assess, to change going forward, because we can't use that excuse anymore. Like white women did this.
Yeah, representation matters.
Absolutely.
But it isn't everything. You know, it's not who you are, but who are you fighting for?
Right.
And these are very important things to consider before we tokenize each other to death.
And only 25% of people in the U.S. as a total, like, support full abortion restriction. The majority of people don't feel that way. So I guess in this case, it's more a representation of your constituents in the fact of
how like the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another show, and I'm sure we'll have a show about the Electoral College. And Beth, if you'd like to come on, you can be a guest. But no, certainly. I mean, I'm not under any illusions, and I don't think that my listening family is either, that we really do live in a real democracy that depends on popular vote. No, absolutely not.
You can't count on rights. I mean, the National Network of Abortion Funds, we kind of work from a framework of reproductive justice, which is a little
not just about abortion.
No, it's entire. Right. It's all encompassing. So
I'm thinking about all of my trans family that are listening or will listen in the future. You know, we stream all of our episodes on KBOO at kboo.fm, so you can listen to it whenever you want to. But reproductive justice includes trans people too.
Yeah.
So first of all, there are plenty of trans men who maintain their reproductive capacity that mm-hmm. that for whatever reason they do not want to undergo surgery to, you know, get like a full hysterectomy or to mm-hmm. Change their hormones so that their bodies are not capable or are hostile to becoming pregnant. But, you know, it's up to them
yeah.
to decide whether or not that's what they want. And trans women can and should be able to freeze their sperm before their hormones absolutely deplete them, and they should be able to use it later if they want to have mm-hmm. a child that is biologically linked to them. And this is all part of a pantheon of reproductive justice, that it's not just abortion.
Yeah, and we can, like, we have Sister Song. They're an organization out of Atlanta, Georgia, to thank for reproductive justice. Loretta Ross coined the term in 1994. It's they view reproductive justice as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, have children, not have children, and parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. So that goes into has roots in a lot of different issues.
Loretta Ross. Thank you, Loretta Ross. I think she's also the woman that coined the phrase women of color as a political category. I think that was her too. So thank you, Loretta Ross, for your fabulous
she's
work.
Yeah, she's a force. Yeah. She's amazing. And so their whole thing is, they're like, the whole structure of that is they want to is to analyze power systems that, you know, that reproductive politics in the U.S. are generally based, they're gendered, they're sexualized, and radicalized acts of dominance that occurred on a daily basis, and reproductive justice works to understand and eradicate these nuanced dynamics. And it's to address intersecting oppressions. You know, they often refer back to the quote by Audre Lorde that says, "Is there no such thing as a single issue struggle, because we do not live single issue lives."
Sure.
So marginalized
praise
women,
the Lord, Audre Lorde.
So marginalized women often face multiple oppressions, and they can only win freedom by addressing how they impact one another. And that's a big part of what we try to consider in every step that we do, because myself as a cis white woman can only make legislation. I only know my knowledge base.
Which is vast. Don't sell yourself short. Go on.
What I'm trying to say is, like, I'm not the only one seeking this out. I'm not the only one that has, and I'm not the only one that will. And we have to consider everybody.
Yeah. Especially poor people, which is why I had you on, right? Because mm-hmm. something that's missing in this conversation is, okay, it's one thing to have abortion rights.
Right.
What about abortion access? Right? Hyde told us,
right,
and thank you for bringing that up, and I might have you read that quote again.
Sure.
Hyde tells us that abortion access has always been something that is classed
mm-hmm.
in many cases. If you have the money,
right,
you can have an abortion, and
right.
that will likely be true even after a ban or series of bans or restrictions come into play legally.
Right. I mean, we all know in a lot of different areas that rights do not necessarily mean access. Right. Like, there's a difference between equality and liberation. Like, rights will give you equality, sure, but like, that isn't necessarily liberation. Are you able to get what you need and live a fulfilled life?
Can you reread what the Hyde Amendment talks about and what the quote?
Yes.
Was, so just so in case people weren't listening in the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1976, the Hyde Amendment was passed by Henry Hyde. He's quoted saying, "I certainly would like to prevent, if I could, legally, anybody having an abortion, a rich woman, a middle-class woman, or a poor woman. Unfortunately, the only vehicle available is the Medicaid bill. And so that is kind of where we see one of our biggest barriers right now is when we've seen women and pregnant people die over it because they're unable to, they have to jump all through all these hoops, whereas if, or try and locate and like pool together all this money, where if they had, but they are on state Medicaid or they're on, you know, they have access otherwise to other health care, but they can't access the health care they need in the moment.
So thank you for that. And I want to again bring up the Northwest Abortion Access Fund and the wider network. If you could just reiterate for the listeners who may not have been listening before, just talk about who you are, what you do, and why you do it.
Yeah. So my name is Beth Vile. I am a board member with the Northwest Abortion Access Fund. I'm also a storyteller with Youth Testify. It's a leadership cohort between Advocates for Youth, One in Three campaign, and the National Network of Abortion Funds. I tell my story of struggle to access abortion as a young person in the state of Oregon, and particularly the fact that I had a later abortion. So what that looked like navigating not only in Oregon, but I had to leave the state, which, you know, like I was saying earlier, rights don't necessarily equal access. I had full rights in Oregon and no access.
How is that that you had?
In my experience, the law had just been passed like 3 weeks before and just came into law. And I couldn't find a doctor comfortable performing that procedure for me. So ultimately, what stood in my way of accessing healthcare was people's opinions, people's own prejudice. And so, and that's not uncommon in a lot of states, most states. We don't expect that of Oregon, but it's not necessarily rare either.
It's pretty stunning to me that people assume that Oregon just by nature is a progressive place. I'm sure everyone listening has left the Portland metro area and sees Confederate flags and Trump flags flying high. The state was founded as a white settler
utopia.
Right? They had it in mind to only have white people here on a right-wing basis, of course. And many of the towns were founded by Klansmen, and there continues to be a legacy that's very rich here of reaction. I'm not quite sure why when people speak about this place, they contrast it to other places that appear to be more backward. But from what I can tell, my reading of the sort of flippant read of the South is pretty thinly coated in racism, because the idea that it's just a backwards place doesn't give any credence to the fact that it is set up that way because the population density so much leans toward more black people.
Right.
And that is how draconian laws and unyielding austerity comes into being.
Right.
Rich white people can convince poor white people in the working class that their enemy are black people, and God forbid they band together, right? So they divide both to conquer each. And then we've got laws in the South that are extremely draconian and ruin people's lives.
Right.
It's because of racism.
Right. Absolutely. And what you kind of see with these laws in Georgia and Alabama is with the way they're set up, not only does it criminalizes the mother, or you know, the parent, and from there, it's so like there's some legislation we've all seen, or you may have seen in Alabama, that if you pursue an abortion, if you try to leave the state, they can, it's like conspiracy to commit murder.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A felony charge and everything. Mm-hmm.
If you are raped and if the child is found not guilty.
Oh, the DA.
Yeah. So okay. If the victim, if the court case falls through and the other person is found not guilty, you can go to prison for false rape allegations, regardless of if it's technicality or what. And also then if you try to abort the pregnancy, there's more time on that. So yeah, in a way, it's a way to fill prisons. Like they want to make it so that prisoners can't have voting rights, and they want to make it so that abortion sends people to prison. Yeah. And you know,
more people in prison for abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Either whether that be
lines up.
Yeah, it's a direct pipe. It's another direct pipeline.
Yeah.
Because criminalizing in that way, and we've even been surprised to see some pretty staunch right-wing people come out and say this is too much government, like this is like Tommy Lauren.
Media darling. No, yeah. She's a right-wing pundit for anyone who doesn't listen to her. Good for you.
Yeah, you're better off.
But yeah, she's a right-wing pundit, and yeah, it was very interesting seeing her come out against. I'm pretty sure they're like drafting her papers to terminate her right now as we speak.
I wouldn't be surprised.
No.
It's a little out of character for her, media persona. But there have been other people, too, that have come forward and been like, this is too much. Like, because there's no exceptions for rape or incest. There's, mm-hmm. If anything, they double down on marginalized people and people who are in crisis, potentially.
Well, certainly it's not just poor women who are the victims of rape and incest in the family or in community.
Right.
It certainly is disproportionately them who experience it. So again, this like strange 1-2 punch of what starts out as a draconian law on women or people who get pregnant,
mm-hmm.
but also you get to kick poor people again and again and again.
Yeah, and there's, if you look at it, like, and people try to use adoption as an alternative to pregnancy, which it really isn't. It's an alternative to parenting.
Have they ever seen? Well, okay, please go on. I have a lot to say about the foster system and adoption.
So, like, 59% of people who seek abortion are already parents. Like, they're people who are trying to provide for the children they already have. If you criminalize them for seeking an abortion and put them in prison, you're removing them from their children and putting their children in foster care. It's you chose to be a parent in the first place, maybe whether that be by choice or by being boxed out from abortion laws.
Sure.
In the end, potentially you could still be separated from your children and still have them end up in foster care.
And not to mention, how many, I would love to see numbers on how many children in foster care become pregnant by their foster parents or people in community. Sexual assault against children in foster care is so rampant that I don't want to, but I could do a show about my friends and family who have been through the foster system that got pregnant in foster care. So, you want to talk about like a cycle of violence, a cycle of criminalization, of misery, of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is a great way to get a jump start. And this is what's on the right wing's mind.
Mm-hmm. Because it's just more bodies. It's more people for them to place
put in
where
prison
they,
or the military.
Yeah, place them where they want them.
Yeah.
It's people who are then under their control, under the government's thumb, in one capacity or another. Or, private prisons too. Like maybe business and government aren't that far apart from each other.
No.
So we know that really, by extension, wherever you end up, if you end up in this awful, vicious cycle,
mm-hmm.
like you you lose the autonomy to choose, you know, and pursue your life.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I'm also watching as people are making hot takes on Twitter.
There's a lot of those.
I want to invite my listening audience to consider the fact that abortion necessarily being a traumatic experience, that is an anti-choice talking point.
Mm-hmm. There's a few that people don't realize they perpetuate.
Yeah.
The no one's pro-abortion talking point is...
Yeah, at least one on KBOO talking to you now.
Yeah, I'm pro-abortion.
Two. There you go.
I'm pro-abortion in that I'm glad abortion exists. I'm glad that I was able to access it. There's also the talking point of... You know, people regret it, that it causes cancer, that it causes, like, it spikes depression and suicide rates.
Does it also prompt hysteria? I mean, who's writing this stuff?
It's beyond me. So okay. And there's also the talking point of it. No one wants an abortion. No one wants to go through this.
Yeah,
and
that plays I've been into the seeing it all week.
And I actually had this conversation with a family member earlier today where they were like, well, I get it. Like, no one wants it. And, like, they were there with me through mine. And I was like, looked them dead in the eye. And I was like, I wanted mine. I wanted it. I didn't want to be pregnant. That's what I didn't want. I couldn't be pregnant anymore. And I didn't want to be. And that was the hard part, was making the choice and finding out I had a pregnancy that I didn't want. And I didn't want to be a part of, and I didn't want to carry. And then making the choice to have the abortion was not hard. Accessing the abortion was hard.
Right. And the stigma.
Oh, and in people's opinions, it's something about abortion that people, there's no filter, there's no manners or etiquette around it anymore at all. People will come right out and tell you how they feel.
People have been coming out and telling you how they feel.
Oh yeah.
I mean, talk about the hatred that you've been receiving.
Okay. I've had some people on Instagram and some news outlets and stuff, write some pretty smearing things about me. But mostly on Instagram, I had people attacking my family and friends.
Yeah, I got it. That was weird. Very strange.
Yeah,
a coordinated effort
It was right after I had an article come out speaking about my my experience accessing later abortion in the United States, and then right before another one came out, and then there was more. You know, it's never ending. It's a matter of just how you field it. I got a lot of people on Twitter tagging me, mm-hmm. Telling me how they feel about my story and my experience, because people don't like that I had a later abortion without fetal anomaly or threat to my health. People don't like that I sought out healthcare and I was able to get it. They don't like that I
am not holding your head down with shame. Is what I keep saying.
They don't like that I talk about it.
Yeah, please. Because in your article is one of the few that asserts a positive experience with abortion. Please talk about your article.
Yeah, so I wrote an article for Teen Vogue. I also most recently did an interview with NPR. And both, I talk pretty candidly about my experience and why I didn't know I was pregnant for so long. I didn't find out I was pregnant until 26 and a half weeks. Originally, the doctors, I accessed some phony healthcare with a crisis pregnancy center here in town. Actually, there's several here in town.
What are their names?
They're called the Pregnancy Resource Center. There's one on 52nd and Powell right next to the Planned Parenthood.
So people should stay away.
Mm-hmm. It's not real, I promise. They'll tell you that you're 10 weeks less pregnant than you actually are.
Can you say the name again?
Pregnancy Resource Center on 52nd and Powell. There's also one in Clackamas, one in Beaverton. They're all over.
And you said they lie.
Yeah. They told me that I was only 16 weeks pregnant. And they had tried to convince me that they were giving me a diagnostic ultrasound when it was not. It was just...
buying more time.
Mm-hmm. They would harass me.
Wasting your time.
Yeah, they'd call me every day insisting that they knew what was best for me and that they suggest that I should pursue adoption. And I said that wasn't really something I was interested in and why was none of their business, and that I was choosing to terminate and they could get lost. And
go for you.
They stopped calling me.
So you managed to finally get what you deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about it with NPR.
Yeah, so there's this schism, this kind of like binary within the whole, like, all the rhetoric around abortion, and that there's like there's good abortions and there's bad abortions. And I inherently fall on the side of bad abortion because I don't regret it and nothing was wrong with me, and there's no way for someone to, I guess in their opinion, excuse my behavior.
As if you're asking.
Yeah. No, I'm never asking. And I'm always apparently I'm always open ears for people, which is fine. I mostly find it kind of funny. You got to cope somehow, humorous.
Yeah, I'm very familiar laughing to not cry. So for other people who want to tell their stories, how can they plug in?
Ooh. So I speak through an organization, mine is a subset of We Testify. The one I'm with is Youth Testify. We Testify is the national network of abortion funds, storytelling cohort and program. We are always looking for more people. Our focus, is on experiences that aren't often heard. You won't see a lot of white people.
Right, I was going to say. So like
I'm one of
queer people, people of color, mm-hmm. actually being able to be heard and uplifted.
Yeah, we've got several. Fabulous. We've got several trans and non-binary people. Almost the entire cohort is people of color, with few exceptions, given that like not many people speak about being teen parents. And choosing their first pregnancy and being unable to access their second, like their abortion, because they're under 18, or they tried to access like an herbal abortion with these, you know, herbs and funguses and things I mentioned earlier. But other than that, it's often the experience that's the most common you'll hear, because abortion access restrictions predominantly impact people of color. And so there's people telling their stories of their multiple abortions, or how they were undocumented at the time, or they were overseas, so there's that. We're like, we'd love to hear your story. We're always listening and we're here to support you too.
Can you just say how people get in touch with We Testify they can tell their stories?
Yeah, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram, we have a website, wetestify.org. Our director, Renee Bracey Sherman, she's pretty public-facing. She's very well-known to the movement, I guess. She's an amazing woman who speaks very candidly about her time accessing abortion in Chicago. And you can always reach out to her, or Kenya Martin. She also helps run it. She's based out of Houston. She talks a lot about her multiple abortion experience. Or any one of us who are a part of it, we'd all love to help you get there and direct you to where you can be best supported, and we can help you speak about your experience in the way that's comfortable for you.
Yeah, I gotta say that that piece about finding people who are supportive of you is really key here, because, I mean, how many stories are we gonna have to read about people who are so mired in shame and guilt and can't handle people judging them as well as you can? They need a community.
Right.
So
often it's after I share my story or I have an interview or an article that people come to me out of the woodwork and they'll be like, I've never told anyone this, but you know, I have also had an abortion. And it's things like that that make it all worth it. That's why I do it. Excellent. If one person can hear my story and identify with it and feel comfortable enough to, you know, share theirs or maybe feel a little bit more validated in their own experience, then mm-hmm. my work here is done. It's not about being in the public. It's about being in the public so that people can know that this is normal and this is, you know, safe and this is available and it's okay and it's very normal.
Mm. Thank you, Beth.
Yeah.
Is there any last words you want to say?
Thank you for having me and for letting me speak about this. I know it's a scary time for everyone right now, especially people, like we kind of said, people are worried about what's going to come forward, but, you know, people have plans. You know, laws or no laws, people are going to, we're going to be there fighting for abortion access, you know, the National Network and the Abortion Care Network.
Period. Good night, everybody.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
You're listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio dial. My name's Lenita Duke, and welcome to a special edition of From the Grassroots, coming up in about 5 minutes.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall. Bodie Phelps was 22 years old when two Gresham police officers shot and killed him on May 24th.